to Encore. Encore is Near FM's Highlights of the Week programme. Now, this week's edition, Liam Nolan is joined on Northside today by Emma Morgan of Fighting Blindness, where they chat about a forthcoming fundraising event. Later, Lakshmi discusses inequality on Lifeline with Professor Kathleen Lynch. And finally, Noel McGuinness is joined on Northside today by Jill Brennan, CEO of the Irish Pro Share Association, where they chat about Keep. But first, on this week's edition of Encore, it's Liam Nolan on Northside today.
On our line here, we have Emma Morgan, fundraising manager for Fighting Blindness. Emma, are you there with us?
I am. Hi, Shane. How are you?
How you doing? Lovely to talk to you today, Emma.
You too. Thank you.
So today you're going to be talking a little about the Keith Duffy and the inaugural Father and Son Run, I believe, and a little bit more about what you guys do.
About what we do. Yeah. So first of all, just to say, Keith Duffy Foundation has chosen Fighting Blindness as one of the charities of choice for this year, and we've been very lucky and very grateful to receive their support. So they're doing an inaugural Father Fun Run, with the first location being in Dublin, and it's in St Anne's Park on Sunday, the 12th of November, and registration will be from 2:30, and the run will take place at 3, and it's a 5K run. And you can either register as an individual, you can register your full family, but obviously the kind of premise will be father and son, kind of playing on the, I suppose, the boys' own song, but also both given more
absolutely
focus.
Yeah.
So the women's mini marathon, for example, there's a lot of focus on the mammies and mothers and daughters, and they can absolutely come as well. But we just thought we'd try and do something a bit different. So we're hoping to have a few hundred people turn up. It's being sponsored by Cost Cutter.
Very good.
And we're delighted that they're going to provide all the goodie bags on the day, and they've been very good as well to the Keith Duffy Foundation, and subsequently we've also benefited from that. We're very, very grateful, so thank you to them and the Barry Group. And just, I suppose, a bit about Fighting Blindness.
Absolutely. One more thing.
Sorry.
That's fine, no problem at all. So I just want to reiterate that, and we'll probably say it again at the end. So at 2 p.m. on Sunday, November 12th, which isn't too far away,
2:30
at St Anne's Park, sorry, at 2:30, excuse me.
Yeah.
And how can people buy tickets for this, if that's all right, if you just want to give us some kind of website?
Of course, they can either go to the Fighting Blindness website, so fightingblindness.ie. They can go to the Keith Duffy Foundation website, so keithduffyfoundation.ie, or they can go on active.com, and it's €15 for an individual. Now, there are other different rates. I know it's €40 for a family, and then we'd ask, because it's the registration fee is going for the setup of the run, but we're asking people, even in families, if they could raise €50. So €50 for a family or a couple or a team, and that will go a long way towards funding services for charities. Like,
oh, absolutely. If you get a team of five, I'm sure €50 isn't too pushy, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
That's fantastic. No, it's really good. So, we will reiterate that towards the end. If you can tell us a little bit more about Fighting Blindness and how you guys are getting on.
Yeah, so Fighting Blindness, we're a patient-led charity. We have a focus on Ireland. We provide free counselling services to people in Ireland affected by sight loss.
Very good.
So that can be either directly if someone has gotten a diagnosis, or it can be indirectly. Sometimes we have parents come to us, for example, if their children have been diagnosed, or we have other family members looking for advice. So we do face-to-face counselling, over-the-phone counselling, and that's on an open-ended basis. So some counselling services will be provided on a block basis, but it's on an open-ended basis to meet people where they're at.
Very
and
good.
Then also we have a School of the Arts, again, where people can avail of different support services. So we have a choir, we have music lessons, and
great.
I think they're opening up comedy, improv, dance, so anything that can help people get on, basically, and help them deal with the fact that they're losing their sight is really important.
And we
have lots of different services that people can find out about. We have a research information line as well. We provide information to people who've been diagnosed, because it's a common misconception that blindness is just darkness, but there's actually a lot of different conditions, either genetic, so inherited passed down, or if you have an underlying condition that's causing sight loss, or if you have an accident or age-related sight loss. So there's a multitude of ways that we provide information and support services, but we also fund research into cures for blindness.
I see that you guys are well established, obviously, since 1983. Yeah. And you guys have have invested 17 million, is that correct, in about 90 vision research projects?
Just under 17 million in research.
That's right. Really, really impressive, I have to say. Really impressive. Well done. Well done, you guys.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you.
So you were saying, so you've invested, obviously, in a lot of different researches. Can you give us a bit of information about some of those?
Yeah, so we've invested nearly 17 million in the last 35 years into research. And we've funded pretty much nearly every university lab in Ireland. And then we have collaboration with various different hospitals. So the Eye and Ear and the Mater would be one. So it's two different projects that I can talk to you about. One is run between the Mater and also the Eye and Ear. And it's called Target 5000. And it's there basically to set up a registry of people with genetic sight loss. There's nearly 247,000 people in Ireland who have a condition where they're losing their sight, and 5,000 of those people would have it for genetic reasons, so they would have inherited it. So to try and find a cure or trials or things that can help people who are going to be effectively passing it on, we're building up a registry where we test these people and trying to see if there's a common reason why they're losing their sight, and there's specific conditions really that affect people with inherited conditions.
So
that's our project. We're trying to recruit the 5,000 people who have these conditions to build up that patient registry, and we collaborate then internationally with other people other groups who would have patient registries. And then, subsequent to that, we are funding a genetic counsellor. So a genetic counsellor would be someone who could give the diagnosis and your options about what condition you have, because you can't just get that, say, in a letter in the door, and a normal GP or even ophthalmologist wouldn't be qualified, because it's so specific. And in Ireland,
it's on a genetic basis per person.
And at the moment, there are apparently there should be about 14 genetic counsellors in Ireland, but there's only 5 or 6. So we're funding a completely new position that will be housed in Temple Street.
That's fantastic.
It's pretty groundbreaking, to be honest.
That's the secondary thing,
and it helps people with family planning. And then the second one that I can talk to you about, there's been lots of different studies, but one of the other kind of very new and exciting ones is a study, a clinical trial. So that's really important. Now, a clinical trial is different to funding lab-based research. Clinical trials actually are working with people to see if they can get results where there's a treatment that is being tested to see if it will actually help. So there's a condition called myopia, which is very common. It's basically short-sightedness, but sometimes short-sightedness is completely uncorrectable. And it can be through our lifestyle. I think in Asia they have a very high amount of myopia just due to so much screen time.
I'd imagine that the screen time doesn't help.
And it can be inherited. And without going into too much, because I'm not a scientist, there can be, I suppose, complications with myopia other than just needing reading glasses. So we have funded DIT, Professor James Lockman, to do a clinical trial for children and young teenagers with myopia, which will consist of drops. So basically trying to see with these specific drops if they'll actually help people or help these children over, I think it's a 2 to 3 year period. So it's a drop that's already in use for lazy eye, but hopefully it will actually reverse, I suppose, the sight, kind of the common sight loss of short-sightedness or myopia. So those are two of the research projects that we're involved in at the moment, but there are many more.
It's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic stuff. I'm really, really excited about what you guys are doing, Emma. Really, really excited. And how can people, other than the run, because we will get back to that in a moment, how can people, number one, contact you guys if you know they want treatment or they want to speak to somebody about help? Because I see that you do a lot of stuff for counselling and stuff for people who are going through
so
this sort of thing?
If people are worried about their sight, if they've gotten, I suppose, a diagnosis from an ophthalmologist, or if they're being referred on to an ophthalmologist after having their eyes tested or a GP, they can certainly call us to discuss their options, whether they need support or whether they need information, and just to be pointed in the right direction.
Oh, absolutely.
So first and foremost, they can contact our office, which is on 01 6789 004. So I'll just say that again. It's 01 6789 004. Or they can visit our website as well, which is fightingblindness.ie. But mostly people would actually telephone us if they're a worry or an issue. And then also just to say, we're 90% funded by the public. So we get 10%. We get a small amount of funding to continue our operations. But all of this is basically carried out through fundraising activities and donations. So that's very welcome as well, if people wanted to go onto the website, or if they wanted to phone in and make a donation, they're more than welcome to. We'd be very grateful.
And that was Liam Nolan, who was joined on Northside Today by Emma Morgan of Fighting Blindness. Next on Encore, Lakshmi discusses inequality on Lifeline with Professor Kathleen Lynch.
Hello, Catherine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, let me introduce you. I don't know whether I need to introduce you, because you're very well known in the community among community leaders. And ordinary community. So, however, I'll just say a little bit about you. Because there's a lot, but I'll say a little bit. Catherine Lynch is the professor of equality studies in UCD, and she has published books and numerous articles on equality and social justice. And her book, Affective Action, Love, Care, Justice, was chosen as one of the 100 best books by Irish Times readers. She's not only known in Ireland, but in Europe, China, and even in Korea. She says, if you want to bring about change, listen to people from outside and not at the table of power. So, Catherine, first of all, could you tell us what is equality studies? I know you started this chat.
Yeah, well, I suppose the whole idea behind it is that you would research all equality issues rather than prioritising one over the other.
Mm.
That whether it's a gender, social class, poverty, racial divides, disability, age, sexuality, everything that could be and possibly is a site of injustice is something that you should study in higher education, and indeed I would argue in society more generally, because equality is a fundamental principle of democracy. And it's a fundamental principle of all the great kind of UN conventions to which we're signatory in Ireland and elsewhere. And it is a very, very fundamental principle for respecting people, and in a way that everybody has an equally good life.
Yes. So in other words, what you're saying is you don't have to be a socialist or a feminist to ask for equality.
No, you don't. And I think those labels of labelling people is actually quite dangerous, because people are put into boxes. And then people, you know, we all have cognitive maps. We have maps we associate certain words with, and certain words have negative connotations, maybe wrongly. And so if you put people into a particular box and you say, oh, you're this or you're that, that's intellectually, in fact, journalists do it a lot. Oh, this person is left-wing, or they're hard left. That's very dangerous thinking. It's intellectually lazy thinking, because people might want a more equal and just society. And there's nothing, you know, reprehensible about that, you know, and labelling somebody is just a way of not engaging with their argument.
Yes, I suppose it's very easy to label, so that it's easy for people to have a, you know, to understand people without actually thinking, probably.
Yeah, I think so. And the same is true of feminism. It's another word that has been deliberately, what would I say, used to label people, like, and it's just about men and women having the same standing, the same rights, and having equal respect for one another. It's really not any more about one person oppressing another. It's not about that.
It's really about equality as human beings, isn't it?
That's right. Yes absolutely.
Yeah.
And
So what you're saying is equality is central in creating solidarity, care, and support of the community.
But I do think so, yeah.
And
I think...
Yeah. and that's the way to create a good household. And that, this is very interesting what you say, that it's about the household and can listen and can then extend it to local community, national, state and beyond, which is a very interesting idea, I think. Now, could you tell us a little bit about, in a little nutshell, it's difficult, but...
I know, I will. Well, I suppose here in UCD, we developed the idea of affective equality, which was to describe the whole world of care. And the whole idea behind it is that in order to survive, everything from the environment to animals, to creatures, to flowers, to ourselves, we all need to be nurtured. And yes, in a lot of our society, when we talk about justice, and we talk about equality, we don't really think of the needs of people for nurturing and care and protecting their rights to be loved and cared for. I would argue that being cared for and being loved both individually and collectively is and should become a human right. Because, you know, emotionally, it's a bread and roses argument. You can't live without food, but neither can you live without love. And it's a huge resource, and it's something we create in life. Like, people are very fortunate, some people have a lot of nurturing inheritance, both individually and collectively, i.e. through their families, or through their communities, or through the country that they live in. There's a very famous book called The Spirit Level, and it shows that some countries are simply much more caring than others. Our northern European neighbours are much more caring societies. I'm talking at the level of the state now, the nation state, in terms of their welfare provision, the protection of elderly people, the protection of children who are vulnerable, than we'd say a very wealthy country, equally wealthy country like the United States. You know, there are far more inequalities, and those economic inequalities translate into care inequalities. So you can't take one without the other. But I suppose if you respond to your question, what I'm saying is, like, that work, the work of actually creating people and human beings and loving and caring for them, is work, of course, that is disproportionately done in families and indeed in a lot of local communities as well by women. And that work is not recognised. It's badly paid, or it's not paid at all. And people claim what is actually work, and is anyone who's got up with a baby during the night or minded your intellectually disabled child that needs to be cared for 24/7, or your, who sometimes can be an adult, who you're minding at home with no support very often, or your elderly parent who you have to get up with at night because they're incontinent, or they're, you know, wandering around because they have dementia. All of that is a huge amount of work. And because the people in power tend not to do it, they don't see it.
Yes.
That is a big problem in society.
They make policies, don't they?
Well, they do make policies, and I would argue that this is one of the biggest, into the future, it is one of the biggest issues, because we are an ageing society across Europe,
yes.
And okay, we have a reasonable birth rate in Ireland, but we also have a massively growing number of people who are not so much older, because I don't want to be ageist about it, I'm older myself, but I mean older in the sense of people with high dependency needs. People, and we live longer, but we also live at the end of our life, if we're fortunate to live long enough, with very high dependency needs. And we haven't really taken that seriously, or the work of it seriously. And it's invisible work that people do at home. I'm sure people listening to you are doing it, and there's very, and you know, you get a pat on the back, but a pat on the back isn't much use to you if you want rest. Back care, you know,
yes.
And you need a week off, or you need a rest, or you need somebody to come in at night, and you only get, you know, whatever it is, maybe 15 hours a week, you know, our home health care is, in fact, that there's nobody, most of the public health services don't provide people for you overnight, and if you've no money, you can't afford to pay for it. So it is a very serious matter, both for the person who's doing the work, but also for people who are ill themselves. They want their dignity, they don't want to be a burden on anybody, and they want to be respected. So I think it's a very, very big issue nationally and internationally.
So what you're saying really is that we have to take care of the carers as well.
Absolutely. I think that, I mean, there are organisations that care for carers, but you can't nurture other people unless you're nurtured yourself. That is a fact. And, you know, we know for people who are caring at home that it adversely affects their physical health and their mental health if they're not supported. So it is a very big national issue, and it's an issue, like, there's this whole attempt to turn the care of the elderly, which I feel very, really needs to be analysed and addressed, into a profit-making business. It is unbelievable that we're doing that. The care of people at the most vulnerable time in their lives is being turned over into profit making. How could a society do that? It would have been unthinkable 50 years ago, even when we were much poorer. But now we seem to think it's no problem that you commercialise it. And, you know, well, hard luck if you need it. And, you know, and if you have no money to pay for it, then, well, one of your family will have to do it. And so I think that those are very serious national issues.
I suppose about carers, they do it with love. You talk about love, which is really interesting and unusual for a professor, an academic, to talk about love and care in that way. Now, for instance, is it, would you say it's compassion we need?
Well, I think that, you know, you can love someone, but love is both a pleasure and a burden.
Yes.
And a responsibility.
Yes.
And it has two sides. And anybody who loves your children, very easy to love young, growing children. But that doesn't mean when you have to get up for work in the morning and you're awake half the night because they're sick, that is not work. I think the failure to reckon, to seal and define something or love and care for others as just a matter of nature is a myth.
Mm.
It isn't.
Yes.
You know, it may, of course, we want to look after those we have and who loved us, and we want to reciprocate it and look after children or neighbours or whoever. But we have to recognise that it takes a huge amount of human effort to do that.
Mm.
And a lot more. Many people will tell you, being on maternity leave in their time, like myself, it's like a holiday coming back to work.
Thank you so much. It's an ocean of wisdom, and there's a lot of food for thought.
Thank you.
And thank you so much. And
you've opened up
huge amounts, a vast area of knowledge.
Yes.
It's only
thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Lakshmi on Lifeline, who was joined by Professor Kathleen Lynch. And finally, on this week's edition of Encore, Noel McGuinness is joined on Northside today by Jill Brennan, CEO of the Irish Pro Share Association, where they chat about Keep.
I have Jill Brennan, and she's the CEO for the Irish Pro Share Association. Good afternoon, Jill. How are you?
Good afternoon, Noel. Lovely to talk to you again.
Okay, this, I take it, is a new initiative.
The key employee engagement programme that was announced in the budget there 2 weeks ago by Minister O'Donoghue is a new initiative. And what it is, Noel, is that it's an initiative to enable small to medium enterprises to attract and retain their key employees by offering them a shareholding in the business in which they're working.
Is it to bolster something that was already there, or is it brand new?
No, there was nothing. There was nothing there before in relation.
Oh, I see.
To it.
Okay.
It is a brand new scheme. Prior to the introduction of the KEEP scheme, the Key Employee Engagement Programme, in the budget, basically, if an employer wanted to give his or her employees a share in the business, those employees were given what's called a share option, and to take up that share option, they were going to be liable for income tax, PRSI, and US. See the minute they took up that share option. Now with the new KEEP scheme, what happens is that once they take up the share option, there's no tax liability, and it's only when they actually can exercise that option and turn it into cash that they would be then liable for capital gains tax on top of that.
Okay.
Prior to this, like I said, they would have been liable for income tax, USC and PRSI. They once they decided to take the option, and then they would have been liable for capital gains tax when they did liquidate or put the share into cash. So they would be getting hit for double taxation and practically wiping out any value that they would have had in relation to the shareholding in the business.
Okay, and before that, it was quite a small percentage of employees anyway, I'd say, to an extent, if you can clarify that for me, would have been a small, compared to the rest of Europe maybe?
Oh, we had a far much lower level of employee share ownership in this country compared to Europe. I think we're in the region of nearly 6% compared to this 27 or 28% in the EU. We have a sad history of not offering employees stakes in businesses here, simply for the reason that the tax liability was crippling. And we're not saying that people shouldn't pay tax. We're saying that everybody should pay their fair and equitable tax. And employees who put so much into growing a business for employers and for founders should be rewarded in some way, shape or form that enables them to continue their commitment to the firm and to keep the firm in the locality in which it was founded as well.
Mm-hmm. And is there sort of a union attached to this, or some sort of a cushion for the employees with this new association?
I'm not quite sure.
Well, you know what I mean? If they have a problem, that they can go somewhere else outside of the environment that they're already in. If they happen to have a conflict with the board, for instance, of a company.
To be honest with you, Noel, that's actually very rare, because what happens is employees who are given this opportunity and who want to take it up, it's not mandatory. So employees who do want to actually take a greater commitment in the firm in which they're working and are actually more engaged, and their voices are actually heard in the businesses, because they have the knowledge and the front of house and the cold face knowledge of dealing with clients and customers on a day-to-day basis, and they know what makes the business work best. Mm-hmm. We find that, in fact, there is very little conflict in employee-owned businesses, because every employee has a voice in that business, and they have only the benefit and the positive nature of the business actually working at the heart of what they do. So we find that this is actually something that there's very little conflict in relation to this. Unions, we don't have any experience of unions actually being involved in employee-owned businesses, because it's something that unions are actually crying out for in some regards, that employees have a voice in the businesses in which they work.
Okay. So is there going to be a campaign to get employees more involved in their job, and will the employer be sort of saying, okay, this is a good scheme, so let's all muster up everyone we can and have a chat about it? Is that what the future is going to be?
Well, what the Irish Social Association wants to do is we want to try and work with the other state agencies, the likes of Enterprise Ireland, IBEC and the Small Firms Association, to educate firms about the benefits of the Key Employee Engagement Programme, the KEEP scheme. Now, the thing is, we have actually been approached by an awful lot of SMEs already to date who wanted to offer their key employees a stake in the business for which they were growing with the founders, mm-hmm. But because they couldn't do it for the tax reasons I outlined earlier, they were imposing a tax liability on their employees, and that was the last thing they wanted to do. Yeah. What they wanted to do was to reward the employee for their commitment to, say, a startup that is now 5 years, 7 years down the line. They wanted to reward those employees who were there at the very beginning, help the business to grow and to achieve what it wants to achieve, and bring them in on board. So that's really what we're looking at. We're looking at SMEs and startups who want to literally bring their employees with them on the journey to creating a long business, a business that has life and sustainability, and brings only good things and benefits to the communities within which these businesses are founded.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were just saying, you know, in regards to the rest of Europe, and that we're sort of 24% lower than other countries. Is this going to be, is it a trial period this is going through, or is this locked in now for future, for everyone, and people can feel comfortable?
Well, that is something that we want to get greater clarification on in relation to the finance bill, which has yet to be finalised and drafted into an act by the end of the year. In the budget documents that we received, and in the finance bill that we received last Thursday, it would seem that this is only going to be for a 5-year trial period. And we think that is in some ways a little bit short-sighted by government, because 5 years is negligible in the life of an SME. We feel that there should be a longer period of bedding in time and getting SMEs up to speed through an awareness program that we want to work, like I said, with the state agency to get out there. The interesting thing about it, though, Noel, is that there is a bit of a conflict in that they are saying to employees who are offered the options that they can hold those options for 10 years, yet they've only given 5 years for the KEEP scheme. So that's where we want to get greater clarification around, like, you know, what are the timeframes that they're putting in place around this, and will they not consider that it actually is more beneficial to the economy in the long term to have a far more productive SME sector that is driven by the both founders and key employees, or indeed all employees, to generate productivity and productivity growth.
Okay, well, you mentioned about the government being short-sighted. I mean, the short term on this, I mean, that's not unusual at all. But it does baffle a little bit, because, as you say, it would take a long time for people to get their heads around it, maybe a year or so in the changes that it would be. And then people are always afraid of putting their feet in the water and saying, oh, is it really worth it? It could all change in 5 years and go back to everything else. So is there no way that you could push them to stretch it out and say, look, just leave it
as it is. You don't need to put a time frame on it at all. Is there any leeway at all, any room, wriggle room there?
We are in discussions currently with the Department of Finance, and we did actually send in some feedback on the finance bill there yesterday. So it is something that we mentioned and that we hope to be working with them on. And the only way we can actually achieve anything is, as we have to done to date, which is that we work with all bodies and all stakeholders in relation to this. In relation to getting SMEs encouraged to consider this as part of their compensation benefits packages that they offer their key employees and some of their senior staff, this is something that they have been looking for quite some time. So I think it will be, in one regard, an easy sell to the SMEs. And also, it is a pretty straightforward piece of legislation. The technicalities lie, I suppose, in the detail. And as I said to in an interview last week, the devil is always in the detail when it comes to taxation. It's never as straightforward as we would like it to be. But this is one of the things that we were emphasising with the Department of Finance and Revenue in the run-up to Budget 2018 was that the key thing here is to make it as simple and as easy and as clear as possible. And the more clearer they make tax legislation now and into the future, the greater buy-in they will actually have from people, because people won't feel that they're being hoodwinked.
Yeah. Now, you keep mentioning SMEs. So is there a limit to the size of the company that can take part in this?
Yes, it is specifically for the SME sector, and it is to bolster and strengthen and increase the growth and longevity of the SME sector. So it is companies with less than 250 employees and with a turnover of less than 40 million a year. So it really does stand out for the vast majority of businesses currently operating in Ireland. In fact, a recent CSO study found that 99.7% of businesses in Ireland are classed as SMEs, and they currently employ 68% of the employed sector in the country.
Okay, well, let's hope, as I say, there's a little more foresight there. And look, we keep an eye on this and see how it goes. Maybe have you on this time next year, if not before, if we have good news across the board, Jill. Thank you very much for talking.
Thank you very much.
Jill. Bye-bye. And that's Jill Brennan, CEO for the Irish ProShare Association. Sounds like a great idea. How could you not just go ahead with it?
Encore for this week. Encore will be back here on Near FM at the same time next Sunday afternoon. That's 4 p.m. Have a terrific week. Bye-bye.